Russia. The Army had earlier worried very little about the fate of the defeated Soviets in the General Staff's planning of Operation Barbarossa. The Wehrmacht was more than willing to abide by the infamous Commissar Order on entry into the Soviet Union. Article 2. The originators of barbaric Asiatic methods of warfare are the political commissars, so immediate and unhesitatingly severe measures must be undertaken against them. They are therefore, when captured in battle, as a matter of routine, to be dispatched by firearms. The Japanese Army, unlike all the other infantry forces of the six major belligerents, was both a military and political force that set national policy. The Minister of War, an office controlled by the Army and often independent from or identical to the Prime Ministry, was ultimately subordinate only to the Emperor himself. Prior to 1941, Japan's recent land wars against Manchuria, 1931, China, 1937, and the Soviet Union, 1939, were primarily army operations, but proved either quagmires or failures. The fact of army supremacy, then, was ironic, given that the Navy and the Naval and Army Air Forces were far better equipped, according to Western standards, than was the Army itself. Prior to World War II, the Imperial Japanese Navy had largely been responsible for the country's more dramatic victories in the Russo-Japanese War, despite some inspired army campaigns in Manchuria. In 1941, the Japanese Army, with 1,700,000 soldiers organized in some 57 combat divisions and various auxiliary units, was larger than any Allied land force other than the Soviet Red Army. But most Japanese manpower was stationed in China and along the Mongolian border, where it had become bogged down since 1932 in a chronic low-level conflict with the Russians. By 1938, there had been over 2,800 incidents between the Japanese and Soviet armies. In a series of intensified border wars in 1939, the Japanese had suffered a climatic defeat at Khalkhin Gol by General Zhukov's superior Red Army armor and artillery. The logical move in 1941 would have been to deploy new units. The Japanese army would steadily grow to over 5 million by 1945 to stabilize China and, in conjunction with Nazi Germany, to invade the Soviet Union. Instead, manpower shortages would continue to dog Japanese strategic ambitions on land. Despite Japan's huge army and its large pre-war population of over 70 million, only about 20% of eligible Japanese were at some time to serve in the military, a smaller ratio of mobilization than was true of Nazi Germany. Until late 1941, the Japanese had not yet fought the British or the Americans, and had some contempt for both despite their own tepid performance against the Soviet Union and China. The apparently dismal infantry performances of France and Britain in May and June 1940 helped to persuade the Japanese army that the democracies were far less formidable than had been the Russians. Timing also was important. The Japanese were still under the impression by late November 1941 that the Wehrmacht would likely take Moscow. The elimination of the Soviet Union might free up more European Axis resources against Britain and thus argue against the deployment of British or even American forces in the Pacific. Ironically, that decision of the Imperial Japanese Army to forego another land war with the Soviet Union in 1941, in conjunction with Nazi Germany, and instead to allow the Imperial Japanese Navy to begin a naval conflict with the United States, may have saved Russia and doomed Japan. What advantages accrued from surprise, prior Japanese involvement in Asia, and general Allied inexperience quickly dissipated by late 1942. Even the inaugural effort of the American 1st Marine Division at Guadalcanal in late 1942, less than a year after Pearl Harbor, demonstrated that the Japanese soldier was no braver than inexperienced American Marines, and much less well-supplied, fed, and armed. Until it had met the Russians along the Mongolian border, May through August 1939, Japanese infantry had never fully been tested by modern Western armor, artillery, and air support. The Japanese Army's victories 35 years earlier in the Russo-Japanese War at the Yalu River and Mukden were over poorly equipped and badly led Tsarist forces, armies not comparable to the later mechanized Red Army of the industrial Soviet state. Japan had never produced a medium, much less a heavy tank, that approximated even early British or American models. It did not fully understand the value of centrally coordinated heavy field artillery. The Japanese were far behind in areas such as self-propelled guns, transport trucks, jeeps, heavy machine guns, and radio-directed artillery fire. Its divisions, on average, were not motorized, much less in reliable radio contact with air support. There was nothing comparable in the Japanese military to the U.S. Navy Seabees, whose mechanized ingenuity proved invaluable in crafting bases and airstrips amid harsh climate, rough terrain, and jungle in the Pacific. Japanese commanders often thought more in operational terms, as if tactical successes at Singapore or the Philippines would ipso facto result somehow in strategic victories. Japan, like Britain, was an island power. But before 1941, it had no real experience in seaborne operations on a scale comparable to the Allied Mediterranean invasions of late 1942. The Japanese lacked the amphibious craft and logistical support to ensure the Army easy passage and adequate supplies, failings that in part doomed the Japanese on Guadalcanal. Whereas the Japanese Army could conduct simple transport of expeditionary forces to ports in China, it had little facility for numerous small amphibious landings against specific islands, unless they were largely uncontested. Aside from Pearl Harbor, Singapore, and the Philippines, the Japanese Army's mode of operation was to grab territory relatively unopposed, fortify it, and then demonstrate to the Allies that the cost to recover it exceeded its value. Yet less than 6 months after Pearl Harbor, and after the draw at the Battle of the Coral Sea, the Japanese already had given up on their planned amphibious assault on Port Moresby on the southern coast of New Guinea. The Imperial Japanese Army remained an enigma. It could fight fiercely in the manner of the Wehrmacht, but was organized and supplied in the fashion of the Italians. It shared both Axis partners' propensity to overrate the value of martial zealotry, deprecate the role of motor vehicles and supplies, and downplay the war-making potential of the Allies. Nevertheless, in a series of island campaigns, as well as during the invasion of Burma, from late 1942 to the last months of the war on Okinawa, the Imperial Japanese Army was able to inflict terrible casualties on Allied forces for a variety of reasons. The Army and its officer corps were far more experienced from a near-decade-long struggle in China than were either their British or American counterparts, at least until 1942 and 1943. Aggressive and savvy Japanese generals of the caliber of Masaharu Homma, Tadamichi Kuribayashi, Mitsuru Ushijima, and Tomoyuki Yamashita, all of whom either were hanged for war crimes at war's end or perished with their troops in defeat, found success early in the war against poorly prepared and demoralized, though not necessarily numerically inferior, Allied troops. Later, they proved masters at studying American amphibious protocols and learning how to exact huge costs while dug in on the defensive. Any time the mechanized mobility and firepower of Allied infantry could be nullified by static Japanese defenses, jungle and mountainous terrain and elaborate fortifications, beneath concrete and coral in idyllic Pacific Island landscapes, American, British, and Dominion casualties skyrocketed. By the 1930s, Japanese militarism had combined traditional strains of samurai culture, Bushido, Shinto Buddhism, and emperor worship with contemporary fascism to excuse military atrocities. A cult arose of modern, supposedly racially superior warriors whose moral worth was calibrated by battlefield prowess and cruelty toward enemies. Since the victories of the Russo-Japanese War of 1904 and 1905, westernization had a paradoxical effect on the Japanese military. Encouraging modernist dreams of reaching mechanized parity with Western powers, while engendering a sense of reactionary contempt for those who saw war in terms of material and machines, rather than manhood. No army had a smaller ratio of wounded to dead than did the Japanese. Nihilistic bonsai charges that were suicidal and brought little tactical advantage were institutionalized, from the Battle of the Tenru on Guadalcanal to bloodier charges on Saipan and Okinawa. In the manner, the German soldiers of World War II were probably more enthused about the idea of war than their predecessors in the German Imperial Army. So, too, the Japanese army that invaded China was indoctrinated in ways not necessarily true during the earlier 20th century, even during its startling successes over the Russians at the Yalu River and Mukden in 1904 and 1905. As General Kojiro Sato put it in his pre-war popular fantasy, If America and Japan Fight, courage or cowardice was the decisive factor, strength or weakness only of subsidiary importance. Strength, however, mattered quite a lot. Despite Sato's fantasies, the Japanese ended up losing 10 soldiers for every British and American soldier they killed. For troops that were soon on the defensive, often immobile and dug in, Japan's light weaponry in theory was not all that much inferior to commensurate Western models. The family of light Nambu machine guns, the Type 89 grenade launcher, the 38 Arisaka rifle, and Japanese 75mm artillery were all dependable and easy-to-use weapons. But without Western opposition until 1939, Japan's armored forces stagnated and remained too light and too small. There were also not enough artillery pieces larger than 75 millimeters. Japanese motorized vehicles were a fraction of what was used by the British and Americans. Although the combined Japanese military reached over 7 million men in arms, reflecting the fact that Japan's population, 73 million at the time of Pearl Harbor, was nearly as large as Greater Germany's, 80 million, the army was outproduced by its allied enemies in every category of weapon system. The United States produced over 2.5 million machine guns, the Japanese less than a fifth of that number. The British turned out 4 million pistols, the Japanese 8,000. The Americans deployed 100,000 tanks and self-propelled guns, the Japanese less than 5,000. Even the Italian army, which disbanded in 1943, had twice as many mortars, 17,000, as the Japanese, 8,000. Over a decade, the Japanese army may have been largely responsible for the loss of over 20 million Chinese, Indian, and Indochinese unarmed civilians. Yet in nearly 4 years of war, the Japanese military managed to kill only about 120,000 British and American soldiers and capture some 70,000, while losing in the process nearly 2 million dead to enemy arms. The Imperial Japanese Army fairly earned the reputation for cruelty. No army in World War II killed so many civilians while being so inept at killing its better armed enemies. The Royal Italian Army literally ceased to exist little more than 3 years after Mussolini declared war on Britain and France on June 10, 1940. Italian infantrymen, like the soldiers of the Wehrmacht, experienced the misfortune of suffering casualties at the hands of every major European belligerent of World War II. The French in June 1940 and again in early 1943, the Russians between 1941 and 1943, the British from 1940 to 1943, the Americans from 1942 to 1943, and in isolated cases during the German-Italian fighting from 1943 to 1945. After an initial victory over the outnumbered British colonial forces in East Africa and in Western Egypt, the Royal Italian Army never won another major battle unassisted. Over 4 million Italians would serve in the Royal Army. Almost a half million were either killed or went missing in combat. Mussolini began the war as a staunch ally of Hitler. Yet more Italians would eventually die in German prisoner of war camps as military detainees or as forced laborers in Germany after 1943 than were captured and held in camps by the Americans. If the Italian army had the least resources of the major powers, inadequate air support, poor supplies, outclassed armored vehicles and artillery, it also took on one of the most ambitious and far-reaching roles of any army in the war. Italy, approximately 45 million people, fielded over 90 divisions, almost nearing the size of the ground combat forces of the United States, with its population of over 130 million. By the time Mussolini had declared war on the French and British, the Italian army was already short of supplies and still recovering from its draining expeditionary fighting in Ethiopia, 1935 and 1936, the Spanish Civil War, 1936 through 1939, and Albania, 1939. Yet another of the many ironies of Mussolini's foreign policies was that he had so overextended his forces in peace that he was entirely unprepared for the German war that broke out in 1939, a paradox that Hitler never quite appreciated, given his apparent ebullience at Italian bullying in the 1930s and chronic disappointment in Italy's incompetence after June 1940. Unfortunately for Italy, Mussolini's initial successes in his pre-war minor interventions against outnumbered and obsolete forces had convinced the fascist government that the Royal Italian Army was somehow a serious, albeit junior, partner to the Wehrmacht. In fact, in every category of military assessment, the Italian army was far inferior to initial British and French armed forces. The Italian wartime economy was the weakest of all the major nations fighting in Europe, taxed especially by Mussolini's insistence on building a huge Mediterranean surface fleet of battleships and cruisers that would ultimately prove of little strategic advantage. Italian industry produced little more than 10% of the vehicles turned out in France and Britain. Italy had only a fraction of the strategic materials, oil, coal, and iron ore, that were available to its enemies. The Italian army had not necessarily deteriorated since 1918, when, as an Allied partner and member of the Big Four, it had finally defeated the Austrians in savage fighting after losing well over a 500,000 men. Rather, the problem this time around was both political and strategic, manifesting itself in at least two pernicious ways. First, Mussolini saw no need to confine the army largely to its proximate northern borders, assuming instead that his new German-Austrian ally provided a valuable buffer that freed his expeditionary forces to be sent to East and North Africa, France, the Balkans, the Soviet Union, and Greece. But that was a role well beyond Italian maritime transportation and logistical abilities at any time. Second, Germany was a poor substitute for Italy's far more powerful former British, French, Russian, and American allies of World War I. The latter coalition had far better matched limited Italian means with their common strategic ends. Mussolini dubbed his far more ambitious Mediterranean agendas in World War II a parallel war, and initially he had been as apprehensive of German encroachment as he was of British resistance. While Italian military craftsmanship was always superb and would produce some excellent ground weapons and prototypes, the Carro Armato P-26-40 tank, SPA Viberti AS-42 armored car, assorted 75mm and 100mm medium field artillery pieces, or the Beretta Model 38 submachine gun, the fascist state had no serious concept of mass production, much less the resources to fuel it. The few competitive weapons that Italy produced either came into production too late in 1943 or in too few numbers. In succession, Mussolini sent the army across the border into France on June 10, 1940, where it was soon soundly beaten even by the collapsing French army. In July, it invaded British Somaliland and enjoyed some success by expelling depleted British garrisons. Yet a year later, most Italian forces were defeated in East Africa. On September 13, 1940, the Royal Italian Army invaded Egypt and was soon repelled by a much smaller British army and forced to retreat 500 miles through Libya, saved for a while only by the arrival of Rommel and the dispersion of victorious British forces to Greece. What was left of the Italian army in North Africa was reinforced in 1942 and partnered with the German Africa Corps. It, too, ceased to exist after the General Axis surrender of May 1943 in Tunisia. The late October 1940 invasion of Greece had proved a disaster, tying down a 500,000 Italian soldiers in the Balkans until the arrival of the Germans, while the army was short of manpower and supplies in East and North Africa. Italy suffered nearly 90,000 casualties in the effort to invade and occupy Greece alone. In his greatest blunder of the war, and such an assertion is always controversial given the nearly endless choices, Mussolini had sent over 10 divisions to the Russian front. At least 85,000 soldiers were killed there, and another 30,000 wounded. Perhaps 20 to 30,000 died in Russian prisoner of war camps. The Royal Italian Army, which was chronically short of supplies in partnership with the Africa Corps, nonetheless lost 1,200 artillery pieces and 18,000 motor vehicles on the Eastern Front. Mussolini had been more worried about losing prestige if the Hungarians and Romanians had joined the Germans without Italians present. Italy must pay our debts to our allies, and no doubt he also sensed an easy German victory and wished to scavenge the anticipated Soviet carcass, especially oil supplies from the Caucasus. In partnership with the German defenders in Sicily, the Royal Italian Army suffered enormous casualties, 140,000 killed, wounded, and missing of its 250,000-man home army. The army was soon disbanded with the general defection of Italy from the Axis cause in September 1943. Had Mussolini not sent forces into Russia and the Balkans, he would have been able to deploy a million-man army in North Africa at a time of relative British weakness and thereby set back Allied progress in southern Europe by at least a year. Mussolini saw willpower as the ingredient for army success. He was oblivious to the fact that morale is often built or eroded by the competency of military leadership and the ability of the home front to provide soldiers with weapons of greater quantity and quality than those of their enemies. Ultimately, the Italian soldier did not wish to fight World War II. If he were forced to, he would have preferred either to deploy on Italy's northern borders or to fight East Africans and small colonial forces in East and North Africa. Instead, Mussolini chose a European war against modern forces and former allies with no history of animosity toward Italy. The army would become expeditionary and thus logically cease to exist just little more than 3 years after going to war. In conclusion, assessments of the respective armies of World War II involved far more than just evaluating infantry forces themselves. By 19th century standards of foot soldiers, largely fighting foot soldiers, the German and Japanese armies may be ranked as preeminent in World War II, given their respective martial zeal and operational competence. But a number of important 20th century developments nullified their professionalism and thereby explained systematic Allied victories on the ground by mid-1943. First, the Allies did not just enjoy superior air power in support of their ground troops, but also attained air supremacy through the quantity and quality of their fighters and fighter bombers, unlimited fuel supplies, and the better training of far more numerous pilots. When Messerschmitt Bf 109s and Mitsubishi A6M0s controlled the skies over Poland, France, or the Pacific, the Japanese and German armies often were unstoppable. When they ceased dominating the air by 1943, they stalled. The German and Japanese foot soldier usually did not fight just his Allied counterpart, but also an array of strafing and bombing planes, as well as vast convoys of freighters that brought food, ammunition, and weapons to their armies in a manner completely unmatched by the Axis powers. Second, the limited industrial base and vulnerable merchant marine of all the Axis powers made it difficult to support expeditionary armies, and yet fighting far from home became the focus of Axis aggression. When the Axis nations sent their ground forces into North Africa, the Soviet Union, Southeast Asia, and the Pacific Islands, they quickly discovered challenges and landscapes far different from their past fighting in their own environs, including far stronger enemies that far better understood the key role of distance in modern warfare as it applied to logistics and mechanized transportation. Ideology, for good or evil, was a force multiplier of German, Japanese, and Soviet armies. Stalin's iron will and murderous regime led both to disastrous encirclements in 1941 and 1942, and to costly but unstoppable offensives in 1944 and 1945. In contrast, the German and Japanese armies could ill afford the no-retreat orders of their fascist leaders at Stalingrad and in the Pacific. The vast expanse, industrial base, and rich allies of Russia gave it tactical and strategic latitudes not available to Germany and Japan. Stalin's stubbornness could lead to the loss of millions of soldiers without collapse, in a way that the obduracy of Hitler and Tojo could not. In an ironic sense, Germany and Japan may have fielded the best individual foot soldiers, but the worst armies. In the next chapter, the string of Germany's successful border wars between September 1939 and April 1941 conspired to ensure the Wehrmacht's later catastrophe in Russia after June 1941. The more that the German army swallowed up weak Western neighbors, the more it believed that its spirit and elan had been the catalysts for its success, rather than the age-old criteria of good weather, easy logistics, and a head start in rearmament and munitions production. Hitler should have learned from the Battle of Britain that the defeat of the Luftwaffe in 1940 and 1941, against an Allied power completely unlike his previous victims, offered a lesson applicable to impending fighting on the ground in Russia. A nation likewise enjoying geographical advantages, foreign sources of supply, sophisticated weaponry, and a population that was willing to perish rather than surrender. Instead, the episodes from Dunkirk to Stalingrad proved a Greek tragedy for the German army. The hubris arising from surprise attacks on weaker nations ensured a terrible catastrophe from doing the same against the one power, the Red Army, that could inflict on the German army 10 times the casualties that it had suffered from all previous conflicts. 12. The Western and Eastern Wars for the Continent. Between 1939 and February 1943, Germany launched a number of successive ground offensives, nine of which involved countries that the German army had either surprise attacked successfully or had belatedly intervened into during ongoing conflicts. Poland, Denmark, Norway, the Low Countries, Belgium, the Netherlands, and Luxembourg, France, Yugoslavia, Greece, the British in North Africa, and the Soviet Union. Meanwhile, the so-called Winter War saw the Red Army invade Finland, November 30, 1939 through March 13, 1940. Yet two continent-wide offensives radically changed the course of the entire war. One ending in June 1940 at Dunkirk on the Atlantic Ocean, and the other at Stalingrad in February 1943 on the Volga River, over 2,000 miles distant. Because Germany had started World War II and was the most powerful member of the Axis alliance, how its ground forces fared in these two campaigns on the European continent determined the course of the war. Whereas the Americans, Italians, Japanese, and Russians all had watched carefully the pulse of the Third Reich's initial border wars that took place in a circumference around the Third Reich, it was the defeat of France and the later surprise assault on the Soviet Union that determined the trajectory of the war in Europe, and to some extent in the Pacific as well. As a general rule, when the German army ground up its neighbors, it earned the eventual participation in the war of its opportunistic partners, Italy and Japan, and for a time the Soviet Union as well. And when the army stalled in Russia, its hold on its alliance weakened, and its operations elsewhere in North Africa, Sicily, and Italy felt the aftershocks. Another theme characterized the two great European continental wars against France and Russia. The French army, the presumed principal obstacle to German expansionism, crumbled in weeks, while the assumed incompetent Red Army ended up in Berlin. Never in military history had a great power so overestimated the ability of one existential enemy, while so underestimating the capability of another. The meat grinder of the Western Front in World War I was replayed in World War II in the East, and the collapse of the Eastern Front in 1917 and the ensuing vast German occupation of 1918 was somewhat repeated in the West in 1940. The strange defeat of the huge French army in June 1940, a catastrophe still inexplicable nearly 80 years later, recalibrated the entire strategic course of World War II. When the war broke out in September 1939, the Wehrmacht had been fixated on one chief enemy, the indomitable French army that had two decades earlier spearheaded the Allied victory over the Kaiser's forces on French and Belgian soil. France, as Hitler frequently expressed in Mein Kampf, was considered the chief stumbling block to German efforts to reassert European preeminence, and it was determined to put its resources into ground forces at a time when other democracies like the British, and soon the Americans, were investing more in strategic air power and carriers. The French, it was felt, might bend, but once more would be hard to break. They certainly would fight on their home soil. They had no intention of a serious peremptory attack on Germany's western flank in 1939, far more fervently than did the Danes, Norwegians, or Poles. In the Finns' dogged resistance to the often poorly planned and conducted Soviet invasion during the Winter War, the Germans had already seen what highly motivated troops on the defensive might do to a much larger, modern-equipped invader. But defeat the French army in the north, the Germans believed, and much of the country would then be neutralized, while the rest of continental Western Europe would fall to the Third Reich and the specter of a two-front ground war would all but end. The chief German paradox of World War II was that it feared the French in 1940 far more than it did the Russians in 1941. But by any fair material or spiritual barometer, the Red Army had greatly improved over the Tsar's military, just as Napoleon had re-energized the calcified armies of the Ancien Régime and was demonstrably the far greater danger to the Wehrmacht. French population, 50 million, and industry, 1938 GDP of about $186 billion, were smaller than the Third Reich's, 80 million GDP of $351 billion, even before the second round of German conquests and occupations of 1939 and early 1940. The French understood demography as fate, and so had begun to rearm earlier than had either the British or Americans. By May 1940, they fielded an extraordinarily large army of over 3 million men and nearly 3,500 tanks. On paper, the French armed forces appeared just as formidable as their heroic predecessors that stood at Verdun, especially in the quality of their fighter planes and tanks. The investments in the Maginot Line were controversial, but nonetheless had resulted in a nearly impenetrable 300-mile wall of defense from Switzerland to Luxembourg, protecting the most accessible pathway into France from Germany. The bulwark also freed up greater numbers of French troops to deploy to the north and east on the mostly unfortified Belgian border. Paradoxes followed. The general defensive mentality instilled by the Maginot Line hampered the offensive spirit needed where its protection stopped, even as the French feared walling off and isolating their Belgian ally to the north that nonetheless could offer no guarantee of keeping the Germans away from France. Even Hitler had assumed that avoiding the Maginot Line and barreling through the top third of France in May 1940 would be only the first phase in a long war of attrition lasting well into 1942. Most at OKW envisioned occupying northern France with a static front against a rump state to the south. Much of Hitler's fear of France and dismissal of the Soviet Union derived from his own past experiences as a foot soldier and the lack of reliable intelligence about the interior and defenses of the Soviet Union. In World War I, Hitler had fought and lost in the West and assumed that other Germans, no better than he, had won on the Eastern Front due only to weaker opposition. He and his generals understood Western Europe well and feared the technology of the Allied militaries, especially French tanks and fighters and British bombers. In contrast, the Nazi leadership was later continually amazed about the source of Russian weapons, as if the unimaginable Soviet losses of 1941 and 1942 should have magically exhausted the huge reserves of the Red Army. In a March 2, 1943 diary entry, Goebbels noted of a conversation with Göring, head of the Luftwaffe, that he, Göring, seemed to me somewhat helpless about Soviet war potential. Again and again he asked in despair where Bolshevism still gets its weapons and soldiers. The Nazis also prioritized France because they hated socialist democracy at the same time that they had a perverse admiration for Soviet totalitarianism, Bolshevik though it was. Hitler repeatedly expressed his respect for the career and methodologies of his one-time collaborator, Joseph Stalin, whose connivance between August 1939 and June 1941 had allowed him to turn westward. But he held only contempt for Western statesmen, consistent with his system of values, then calibrated morality by degrees of perceived ruthlessness. Western Europe represented less than 20% of the landmass of the Soviet Union. Most important, it possessed good roads and standardized rails, and lacked the room of Russia in which invading armies might be swallowed up pursuing retreating forces. The battlefields in the west were near the German Ruhr. Resupply was easy compared to sending material across the expanse of the Ukraine. Familiarity between the French and the Germans, both being of a kindred Western European heritage, meant that the war likely would lack the barbarity of the later Eastern Front. Those surrounded would likely surrender because they had hopes of being treated with European humanity. Hitler apparently believed that in any future war the Soviets would fight well, and yet the Wehrmacht would easily prevail because of Russian backwardness. In contrast, the French might not fight as well, but might still hold out because of their comparable arms and experience. That mostly the opposite occurred explains much of the strange war that followed. On May 10, 1940, Hitler invaded Belgium, France, and the Netherlands with over 3 million men, nearly 2,500 tanks, and over 7,000 artillery guns. Yet the targeted Allied Western democracies, in response, could in aggregate muster more men, armor, and planes. That fact had initially spooked the planners of the German High Command, who also were concerned that half their conscript invading army had little experience or training. And they had further reasons to worry because two-thirds of German tanks had proven already obsolete after just 9 months of war. Mark I and II Panzers, still the vast majority of German armor, were clearly inferior to the majority of French armored vehicles. France, given its far smaller territory and lack of sizable lend-lease shipments, by itself was incapable of rebounding to mobilize the vast manpower or industrial reserves that later characterized the Soviets' recovery from invasion in 1942 through 1945. For a variety of self-interested reasons, Belgium, Britain, Denmark, France, the Netherlands, and Norway had never coordinated well their respective forces or munitions industries, and so their paper strength always proved a chimera. After the destruction of Poland and Czechoslovakia, the small Western democracies had either hoped to fight from fixed positions or expected that Hitler would turn his attention mostly to their British or French neighbors. It was never the pre-war British intent to deploy vast ground forces in the West for a joint defense of French soil at the levels characteristic of 1914 to 1918, between 1.5 and 2 million troops, and so Britain kept its air and expeditionary ground commitments at somewhat over 300,000 soldiers by May 10, 1940. Most of the divisions that were sent were hastily mobilized, largely untried and ill-prepared. General Alan Brooke, commander of the British Second Corps, admitted in November 1939, on arrival in this country, France, and for the first 2 months, the Corps was quite unfit for war, practically in every aspect. To send untrained troops into modern war is courting disaster, such as befell the Poles. The French military had poor communications with few radios to coordinate armored infantry and air support. Confused and aged officers were not nearly as able to use their formidable assets as were the Germans. Later, General Wilhelm Ritter von Thoma attributed the German armored victory to concentrations of force, especially to tanks and planes blasting away corridors of resistance, rapid movement during the night, and autonomous mobile columns that brought their own fuel and food. Marc Bloch, the legendary French historian and combat veteran of the defeat, agreed. The ruling idea of the Germans in the conduct of this war was speed. We, on the other hand, did our thinking in terms of yesterday or the day before. Worse still, faced by the undisputed evidence of Germany's new tactics, we ignored or wholly failed to understand the quickened rhythm of the times. The German General Staff had advanced and rejected various and mostly predictable plans of attack before agreeing on a more unexpected approach, in part due to fears that original, traditional agendas of a broad assault had been compromised and that their plans had fallen into the hands of the Allies. The quite radical element of the new version of attack, the so-called Manstein Plan, was a central strike through the supposedly rugged Ardennes forest into Belgium, well above the Maginot Line, and an assumption that once the Allies saw that they were not so much outflanked to the north in Belgium, but rather sliced by sickle cuts from behind through the Ardennes, strategic chaos would follow. Sending the smaller Army Group C to the south against the Maginot Line would cause most of the French forces not trapped near Belgium to fear being caught in another pincer. Cutting the larger Allied defenses in two, the Germans would emerge from the forest and push to the coast. The Allies who were stacked on the Belgian border would be cut off from their communications with most of France to the south and be driven to the sea. At first glance, the German plan seemed irrational. The British and French together could send up superior air cover. The Dutch and Belgians were not quite paper tigers. Together they had adequate arms and would be fighting on familiar terrain, perhaps on the flank of the Germans, while the Wehrmacht's main force struggled through forests and crossing rivers. The vast majority of French territory to the south would be still untouched by war, its factories and manpower reserves free to send in newly equipped armies. Yet after the Ardennes surprise, the French-British force collapsed in 6 weeks. In retrospect, the reasons for this stunning defeat seemed manifold. Antiquated French tactics of static defense, the lack of a muscular and mobile central reserve, a failure of the British, French, Belgian, and Dutch defenses to coordinate their efforts, inadequate communications and poor morale, all the wages of a decade of appeasement and more than 8 months of sitting after the invasion of Poland, along with a fossilized high command of aged generals. Mark Bloch again summed up the collapse of Western Europe as a strange defeat, given that the Wehrmacht invaded France with almost 1 million men fewer than the aggregate number of men under arms in the Netherlands, Belgium, France, and the British Expeditionary Force, as well as a shortfall of over 4,000 artillery pieces and 1,000 tanks. On the eve of the invasion, the French military had been steadily growing while the Germans were still replacing equipment from the campaigns in Poland and Norway. French author and later resistance fighter André Maurois remarked of the abrupt collapse, "The myth of the enemy's invincibility spread rapidly and served as an excuse for all those who wanted to retreat. Terrifying reports preceded the motorized columns and prepared the ground for them. The city was buzzing with rumors. The Germans are at Douai. The Germans are at Cambrai." All this was to be true a little later. At the moment, it was false. But a phrase murmured from shop to shop, from house to house, was enough to set thousands of men, women, and children in motion, and even to startle military leaders into ordering their detachments to retire toward the coast, where, as it turned out, they were captured. All this defeatism was a long way from Marshal Ferdinand Foch's famous defiance regarding his embattled French forces at the First Battle of the Marne, some 26 years earlier. "My center is giving way, my right is retreating, situation excellent, I am attacking." The Germans had planned an armored attack that had never been tried by an army on such a vast scale. The huge invading force, in characteristic German fashion, was divided into three groups, A, B, and C. And the senior army group commanders, Gerd von Rundstedt, 45 divisions, Fedor von Bock, 29 divisions, and Wilhelm Ritter von Lieb, 18 divisions, were the Wehrmacht's superstars. Von Rundstedt and von Bock had supposedly already changed the face of battle in Poland the prior autumn, and now were charged with conducting large encirclements on an even grander scale. Group B was to rush into the Low Countries to tie down and push back the British and northern French armies, with Group A barreling through the Ardennes to split the Allied armies in two. Group C planned to assault the Maginot Line while preventing counterattacks from the south on the Germans' northern flanking movements. The French had believed that the legendary impenetrability of the Ardennes made it a natural extension of the Maginot Line, perhaps because they assumed all motorized divisions were as cumbersome as their own columns. In fact, the mountainous forest of the Ardennes, compare Latin ardus, steep, was mostly less than 2,000 feet in elevation. It was not nearly as impassable as its reputation suggested. Generals Heinz Guderian, a panzer group commander, and Erich von Manstein, a staff planner and corps commander, both felt that the Ardennes, in fact, offered an open doorway to the coast. The idea that the Germans would dare attack through both the mountains and against the Maginot Line would only enhance their reputation for audacity and contempt for conventional military wisdom. The realization that Germans were streaming in where they should not have caused immediate panic. The war, Mark Bloch later wrote while a prisoner of war, was a constant succession of surprises. The effect of this on morale seems to have been very serious. A year later, a similar surprise three-part plan of attack under the same three army group commanders would mark the invasion into the Soviet Union. The sudden surrender of a 500,000 stunned French troops on June 22nd ended the war. But there were still far more armed French troops in the center and south of the country, and almost as many potential partisans, the nucleus of a national resistance that might have turned rural France into what later followed in Yugoslavia under Josip Broz Tito or in central Russia. However, few French leaders called for a guerrilla war or even for a concentrated retreat to a redoubt in the south. The better of the World War I French generals, Louis Franchet d'Esperey, Ferdinand Foch, and Joseph Joffre, were dead, and the most innovative by French standards were too young, or in 1940 lacked sufficient rank, Charles de Gaulle, Henri Girard, Philippe-François Leclerc, René-Henri Olry, Jean de Lattre de Trosny. It was difficult to judge which of the commanding aged French generals, Maurice Gamelin, 67, Alphonse-Joseph Georges, 64, Maxime Weygand, 73, proved the most defeatist. The French largely accepted the collaborationist visions of Marshal Philippe Pétain, 84, rather than wishing to emulate the Finns. General Alan Brooke, veteran of World War I in France, an admirer of the French, and a British liaison officer with the French military in 1939, also despaired at the pre-war French army's lack of morale. "Seldom have I seen anything more slovenly and more badly turned out. Men unshaven, horses ungroomed, clothes and saddlery that did not fit, vehicles dirty, a complete lack of pride in themselves or their units. What shook me the most, however, was the look on the men's faces, disgruntled and insubordinate looks, and although ordered to give eyes left, hardly a man bothered to do so." Both the Western democracies, France, Belgium, the Netherlands, Luxembourg, and the British Expeditionary Force, and the Soviet Union fielded more troops than did the attacking Wehrmacht during its respective two invasions on May 10, 1940 and June 22, 1941. Both initially had as many planes and tanks as the Germans. In many cases, their arms were of similar or superior quality to those of the Third Reich. Both the democracies and the Soviets were also similarly stunned by the German army's surprise attacks, and their generals were left demoralized and confused. What, then, was the key difference in their contradictory abilities to survive the first few weeks of Blitzkrieg? Whereas morale in the West imploded, it rebounded in the East. Historians ever since have argued over this strange disconnect, especially given the inverse experiences of World War I that had seen the democracies survive and Russia capitulate. They often correctly cite the vast expanse of the Soviet Union that allowed strategic retreat. The murderous authoritarianism of the Soviet state certainly made capitulation a capital crime. The harsh weather of Russia aided the defenders, and the chronic impoverished conditions of Russia created a desperation not found in France and the Low Countries during the post-Versailles 1920s and 1930s. Yet whatever the precise causes for such different resistance, the reactions to Hitler's early continental wars remind us that hackneyed military aphorisms of the superiority of the moral and spiritual to the physical and material are not so hackneyed. Yet victory posed problems for the Germans. The Third Reich was immediately entrusted with occupying about 400,000 square miles of additional territory in Western Europe, in addition to governing Belgium, Denmark, Norway, and Poland. Hitler never really fully appreciated that each serial conquest in Poland, Denmark, Norway, the Netherlands, Belgium, Luxembourg, France, Yugoslavia, and Greece required tens of thousands of occupation troops that otherwise might have served on his envisioned future front against the Soviet Union. Hitler also never comprehended German lessons of occupation after the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk of 1918, when German control of newly acquired vast swaths of Bolshevik Russia tied down a million German soldiers, ensuring that there were not enough German troops rushed westward to stem the flow of arriving Americans into France. Hitler, in the months after the fall of France, toyed with plans to demobilize thousands from the army, so convinced was he that the shock over the destruction of the once great French army would leave the Western world in utter despondency. In private, he worried over the fact that an Allied naval blockade and years of military buildup and now war were pushing the German economy to near financial insolvency. In any case, he assumed that the Munich generation of British diplomats would soon come again to Germany for terms. Without an end to the Allied maritime embargo, most thought it unlikely that Hitler would start yet another new war with the Soviet Union, which, after all, supplied almost a third of German oil. Although France fell in less than 50 days and suffered over 350,000 casualties, the German army itself took substantial losses, an often forgotten fact of the supposed walkthrough. Nearly 50,000 were killed, later died from wounds or were declared missing. Over 100,000 were wounded. A 6 weeks butcher's bill for victory comparable to the American losses in defeat after a decade of fighting in Vietnam. The relatively rapid conquest of all of continental Europe and the war at sea between September 1939 and June 1940 had still come at the cost of 100,000 German dead and over three times that number of wounded. The serial wars in Poland, Western Europe, Norway, and the Battle of Britain, and more casualties to follow in spring 1941 in the Balkans, would cost the Luftwaffe over 2,000 fighters and bombers, as well as hundreds of key transports. Although undefeated in all these conflicts, the Wehrmacht was not necessarily in an improved strategic position even after the fall of France. The victory required a careful balancing act between outsourcing some occupation responsibilities to a supposedly autonomous turncoat Vichy government, at least until November 1942, and yet deploying enough soldiers, roughly 100,000, to keep resistance to a minimum. Soon the Italian army in North Africa was collapsing after a few months of fighting. Spain's autocratic leader, General Francisco Franco, now seduced, now rebuffed by Hitler, would not bring Spain into the war, ensuring that Gibraltar would still control the Western Mediterranean's entry and exit. The Wehrmacht would learn that it could neither invade nor bomb Britain into submission. For all its successes, the frightening U-boat campaign had not cut off Britain from imported resources. In sum, there were enough worries for a depleted Wehrmacht without attacking the Soviet Union, which now shared a border with the Third Reich, to say nothing of starting a war with the United States. There was a final irony of the catastrophic fall of France. Within a year and a half of the French collapse, the long-term future of Europe would be more favorable to the defeated than to the victors. The free French people were to gain a generous ally in the United States, while Germany was to acquire a multifaceted enemy that it could not defeat in Russia. June 1940 was not quite the end of France. By the end of June 1945, there would be French soldiers in occupied Germany and no Germans left in France. The two superpowers on the Eastern Front in 1941 remained more alike than different. Both were autocratic. Both had no compunction about murdering millions of innocent civilians. Both had made contingency plans to attack one another. Unfortunately, both de facto allies also shared a common border in occupied Poland after 1939. Germany and Western Russia were the largest states in Europe. Each had huge armies and controlled a vast empire of occupied territories. Neither believed in the Western democratic notion of rules of modern warfare. So a land war like no other would follow on the Eastern Front. The German army that invaded the Soviet Union on June 22, 1941, once again achieved complete initial surprise despite weeks of blatant overflights of Soviet territory, near exact Russian intelligence about the date of the impending surprise attack, serial warnings to Stalin from the British about Hitler's planned perfidy, and the obvious massing of German troops along the Russian border. This was the third occasion after the assaults on Poland and France that well over a million German soldiers had staged a three-pronged attack without warning. The Axis army of nearly 4 million was not just the largest invasion force in history, but also the greatest European invading army that has ever been assembled anywhere, 6 times larger than Napoleon's force that took Moscow. The general plan, there was no sense of a master strategic blueprint that was sacrosanct, was to trisect the Soviet Union through vast panzer sweeps that would encircle and destroy Western Russian armies before they could flee and regroup in the defense of Moscow and Leningrad. The army groups would enlist regional allies in their own particular geographical spheres of interest, Finns in the north, Hungarians and Romanians to the south, each spurred on by their own traditional border disputes with Russia and the possibility of recovering lost territory. Hitler thought the potential fruits of a victory over the Soviet Union were irresistible. The entire continental European war would now conclude in German victory. German chronic worries over food supplies and oil would fade. The position of an isolated Britain would prove nearly untenable, and Eastern European squabbles would be adjudicated by grants of Soviet borderlands. As it was, June 22nd marked the beginning of the most horrific killing in the history of armed conflict, a date that began a cycle of mass death and destruction over the next 4 years at the rate of nearly 25,000 fatalities per day until the end of the war. Hitler's fantasies were to shock and awe the Soviet government into paralysis, thereby freeing up Eastern living space, Lebensraum, for planned arrival of German settlers, thus obtaining natural wealth and food for the resource-hungry Third Reich that would make Germany immune from British and American sea blockades of key materials. A continental superstate of some 180 million citizens would supposedly be at the mercy of an 80 million person Reich, that was already stretched thin from northern Norway to the Atlas Mountains and from the English Channel to eastern Poland. Hitler believed that his rapid progress across the Soviet Union would likely destroy Bolshevism, subjecting supposedly inferior peoples to either mass death or slavery, and turning the Soviet Union into German-controlled feudal estates, at least to the Dnieper, Don, and Volga rivers. The Third Reich could then build a veritable living wall of permanently based Wehrmacht soldiers further eastward at the historic dividing line between Europe and Asia at the foot of the Ural Mountains, and let what was left of eastern Russia starve. As early as summer 1940, Hitler even went so far as to believe that by attacking Russia, and no doubt knocking it out of the war, he would relieve the Japanese of worries in their eastern theaters and thereby assist them in neutralizing the American Navy that was increasingly aiding the British. In Hitler's mind, his Air Force and Navy had lost against Britain, but his army still remained undefeated and invincible. Hitler also scapegoated the Soviets for supposedly falling short of their trade and commercial obligations to the Third Reich under terms of their non-aggression pact. He was especially irritated by Russian aggression in Eastern Europe, Finland, and the Baltic states, as if there should have been some honor among thieves. In early 1941, he whined to Admiral Raeder of Stalin's demand to take all the oil of the Persian Gulf rather than divide it with the Third Reich. He resented Stalin's apparent politicking in the Balkans with communist liberationist movements. Goering later claimed that after the Soviet sudden invasion of Finland, the Nazis believed that Stalin might strike them at any time. For all Hitler's wild talk of needing resources, it nevertheless may have been true that the Wehrmacht's mobilization and near 2 years of warring were becoming unsustainable without new sources of food and oil. Post facto, these rationales all seem little more than fantasies, but in spring 1941 to an undefeated Wehrmacht, they seemed reasonable. The German high command had a bad habit of prematurely assuming victory. In July 1941, the chief of the German Central Staff, General Franz Halder, famously wrote in his diary just 2 weeks after the start of Operation Barbarossa that, "On the whole, then, it may be said even now that the objective to shatter the bulk of the Russian army this side of the Vina and Dnieper has been accomplished. I do not doubt the statement of the captured Russian Corps CG, commanding general, that east of the Vina and Dnieper we would encounter nothing more. It is thus probably no overstatement to say that the Russian campaign has been won in the space of 2 weeks." Halder would have been right if destroying large Soviet armies in Western Russia and soon occupying perhaps 20% of total Soviet territory could be considered synonymous with the defeat of the entire Soviet Union. But the German theory of victory made sense only if one assumed that the Russians would, as expected, continue to fight as unimpressively as they had initially, or previously in Finland or Poland, or as the French had earlier. Or if the German army maintained the same ratios of manpower and weaponry that it had enjoyed earlier in France. Yet there was no historical evidence that the Russian army had ever fought in lackluster fashion on its own soil as it so often did abroad. Nor were there many examples of Mother Russia ever running out of manpower to stop an invasion. One of the chief architects of Operation Barbarossa, General Erich Marx, had assumed in his planning that the occupation of industrialized European Russia would fatally cripple Soviet productive capacity. The sudden destruction of existing Soviet military forces would mean that replacement men and material would either come too late or in too small numbers to affect the outcome. German logic was that if Stalin's initial fears of potential German power had earlier persuaded him to seek the non-aggression pact with Hitler in August 1939, then he might sue for concessions once he experienced the reality of such force used to deadly effect against Western Russia. In World War I, Hitler remembered the communists as ideologues rather than nationalists had been eager in March 1918 to quit the war and, with the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk, accept almost any compromises demanded of them by the occupying Germans. Hitler entirely misread Stalinism, thinking it an incompetent globalist communist movement rather than a fanatically nationalist and, in some sense, czarist-like imperial project. Despite Stalin's foolhardy initial refusals to trade space for time, Hitler again failed to appreciate historic Russian defense strategy based on ceding swaths of territory on the assurance that the sheer size of Russia would eventually exhaust the occupier, while still allowing plenty of ground for retreating Russian forces to regroup. Tsar Alexander I had famously warned the French ambassador in 1811, a year before Napoleon invaded his country, "We have plenty of space, which means that we never need accept a dictated peace, no matter what reverses we may suffer." With the failure to take either Moscow or Leningrad by late 1941, or to destroy the Red Army and the Russian munitions industry, the Germans had already lost the war against the Soviet Union, making their defeat and occupation of European Russia an expendable lizard's tail that was shed without killing the once attached body. Each day that the Wehrmacht went eastward as summer became autumn, it became ever more anxious to end the conflict outright. As late as October 1941, the General Staff still believed it could take Moscow and win the war before winter, especially given the huge encirclements and haul of prisoners at Vyazma and Bryansk. General Edward Wagner of the Supreme Command of the Army on October 5th wrote, "Operational goals are being set that earlier would have made our hair stand on end, eastward of Moscow. Then I estimate that the war will be mostly over, and perhaps there really will be a collapse of the Soviet system. I am constantly astounded at the Führer's military judgment. He intervenes in the course of operations, one could say decisively, and up until now he has always acted correctly." Wagner, eventually to commit suicide as a co-conspirator in the 1944 plot against Hitler, would change his rosy prognosis in less than 3 weeks, and thereby reveal by his fickleness that the generals were just as foolhardy as their Führer. "In my opinion, it is not possible to come to the end of this war this year. It will still last a while. The how? It is still unsolved." By November 7, 1941, Hitler himself was admitting to his generals that the original objectives of Operation Barbarossa, driving the Russians east of the Volga and capturing the oil fields of the Caucasus, would not be reached in 1941. The next day, in a public address at Munich, he disowned Blitzkrieg, which he now dubbed an idiotic word. The Eastern Front saw two general phases of fighting. The brief first interlude was the initial German offensive of June 22, 1941, that stalled on all fronts in mid-December 1941. It resumed in the south in spring 1942 and ended for good in the deadly cauldron of Kursk in July and August 1943, leaving outnumbered German troops on a vast 1,000-mile front from Leningrad to the Caucasus inadequately supplied, outnumbered, and facing partisan resurgences to the rear. When most initial German offensive operations ended, the Eastern Front then entered a second cycle of stubborn and sustained Russian offensive operations, punctuated by occasional German counterattacks. The slowness of the Russian recovery in 1942 and 1943 illustrated the skill of an outnumbered German army on the defensive, one that gave up the same, though less familiar, territory far more slowly than had the surprised Russians in summer 1941. By 1944, the Red Army, now nearly twice as large as the German army, that in turn was, for a while longer, still larger than when it had entered Russia in June 1941, had advanced the Leningrad-Moscow-Stalingrad line to near the borders of East Prussia and was approaching Eastern Europe. By early 1945, most of the territory of the Eastern European allies of the Third Reich was either under Soviet occupation or their governments were joining the Red Army as Stalin prepared for the final spring 1945 offensives into Germany and Austria proper. Hitler's habit throughout the ground war against the USSR was to focus on Russian casualty figures rather than Russian replacements. Such adolescent thinking was characteristic of Hitler's entire anti-imperial appraisal of Soviet air, armor, and artillery strength. General Günther Blumentritt, deputy chief of the General Staff in January 1942, noted of Hitler's fantasies, "He did not believe that the Russians could increase their strength and would not listen to evidence on this score." There was a battle of opinion between Halder, chief of the German General Staff, and him. When Halder told him of this Russian numerical superiority, Hitler slammed the table and said it was impossible. He would not believe what he did not want to believe. By German logic, the Russians should have quit like all of Hitler's initial victims. Half of Russian tanks in 1941 were obsolete. Nearly 80% of Russian planes were outdated. But from the outset of the conflict, the outcome did not hinge on initial German superiority, but on whether Hitler's advantages were of such magnitude as to offset the vast geography and the huge manpower and industrial reserves of the Soviet Union. Should the Wehrmacht not knock out the Red Army in weeks, the Germans would then find themselves in a war of attrition far from home, amid hostile populations, and an enemy that had manpower reserves double those of the Third Reich. Prior to Operation Barbarossa, the German army had not traveled on land much beyond 200 miles in any of its prior campaigns, and had not fought a total war since 1918. Within 6 months of the invasion, Germany had occupied nearly 1 million square miles, the home of 50 to 60 million Russians, between one-quarter and one-third of the Soviet population, while killing or putting out of action over 4 million Russian soldiers and obtaining about half the food, coal, and ore sources of the Soviet Union. Hitler ranted about his invasion being a clash between Western civilization and the racially inferior Slavic hordes of the East. There was a scintilla of truth to his idea of a vast multinational European anti-Bolshevik crusade, at least in the sense that, of the nearly 4 million Axis invaders, almost 1 million were Finns, Romanians, Slovakians, and eventually substantial numbers of Hungarians, Italians, and Spaniards, in addition to volunteers from all of occupied Western Europe, along with scavenged trucks, tanks, and artillery pieces from now-defunct European militaries. By 1942, the Third Reich's 80 million people had been augmented by perhaps over 100 million in Axis-occupied and allied Europe, while an expanded Soviet Union's 180 million had been reduced below 150 million due to German occupation and losses. Yet the Soviets, by 1943, usually fielded a frontline army on average of about 6 to 7 million, nearly double the size of the Axis divisions on the Eastern Front, despite losing over 4 million in the first 12 months of the war. The anomaly was not explicable by the fact that the Germans drafted a smaller percentage of their population. Both militaries eventually conscripted somewhere between 13% and 16% of their available manpower pools. The Soviets were also able to put more of their wounded back at the front while enlisting some 2 million women in combat units. One way of understanding Operation Barbarossa is Hitler's attempt to fight the Soviet Union on the cheap without sizable reserves of manpower and equipment, if the original invading army of 4 million Axis soldiers can ever be called inexpensive. He now owned the largest industrial base in the world, and yet failed to fully mobilize the potential of all of Axis-occupied Europe, given that the German economy was parasitical and extracted from rather than invested in its occupied conquests. There were lots of other reasons why the German invasion failed. The original objective was never spelled out, but was unspoken and assumed by OKW and OKH. Was it to be a direct assault on Moscow to force the protective mass of the Red Army to show its strength in one colossal battle and thus be destroyed between gigantic German pincer movements, then to ensure the capture of the iconic capital and nerve center of Soviet communism? No one knew, given that Hitler focused alternatively on the northern and southern flanks. As his generals in Clausewitzian fashion harangued that the focus of the front was Moscow, where the Soviet army would swarm and thus could be surrounded and destroyed, Hitler answered with lectures on the northern industrial potential and the strategic location of Leningrad and the southern food and fuel riches of the Ukraine and Caucasus. "My generals understand nothing of the economies of war," Hitler screamed to General Heinz Guderian, who objected to the controversial August 1941 diversion of Army Group Center panzers away from Moscow to the Ukraine. Hitler insisted that he had studied Napoleon's failure of 1812, and therefore was not obsessed with taking Moscow, of no great importance, whose capture had brought the French no strategic resolution. Still, he and his staff seemed ignorant of an entire host of history's great failed Asiatic invasions. Darius I's Scythian campaign, Alexander the Great's exhaustion at the Indus, the Roman Crassus's march into Parthia, and the Second through Fourth Crusades. The impressive initial strength of all these efforts had proven hollow, given the magnitude of the geography involved, the supplies needed, and the war's ancient laws that invading forces weaken as they progress, sloughing off occupation troops, protecting always lengthening lines of supply, wearing out men and equipment as distances increase, and running out of time before autumn and winter arrive. Hitler's coalition army was perhaps sufficient to take Moscow and Stalingrad, but not to divide into three separate army groups along a 750-mile front that would expand even further from the Baltic to near the Caspian Sea. The German generals, albeit mostly later in post-war interviews, had argued that a focus on just Leningrad or Moscow might have succeeded, but the long trajectory of Army Group South toward the Volga River, both in 1941 and 1942, subverted all three efforts. Another flaw in Operation Barbarossa was the diversion of enormous German resources for non-military objectives that made the conquest far more difficult, specifically the huge military resources devoted to the final solution. According to Nazi logic, the so-called Jewish question could not be fully addressed unless Hitler moved into eastern Poland and western Russia, the historical home of the vast majority of European Jews. In addition, as German casualties climbed and the war with the USSR went into its second and third years, Hitler increasingly fell back upon the self-serving rationale that the invasion had been defensive and preemptive, a desperate act to hit Stalin before he would do the same to Nazi Germany, an allegation that only scanty post-war evidence might support. Yet for once, Soviet Minister of Foreign Affairs Vyacheslav Molotov told the truth when apprised of the surprise attack in its first hours by the German ambassador in Moscow. Surely we have not deserved that. Yet in the end, the real reason for invading the Soviet Union may have been simply because Hitler thought that after conquering all of Western Europe and controlling most of Eastern Europe, he could do as he pleased and do so rather easily. Hitler, always the captive of paradigms of World War